We made this.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Van Allen. I wrote episode 8, Familiar, of season 11 of The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Everyone to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and this is a very special episode of the podcast as I have the pleasure of talking to another part of the X-Files writing and production team from the original run of the show, a prolific and celebrated television writer, producer and director in his own right, Jeffrey Bell. Jeff, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Well, as listeners will no doubt be aware, you wrote 5 episodes of The X-Files between seasons 6 and 8. The Rain King, Alpha, The Goldberg Variation, Signs and Wonders, and Salvage. All very different stylistic outings for the show. But I thought before we get to discussing those and your broader career, parts of that, can we start with your origin story? So how did you get started in the business at the very beginning?
Sure. I grew up in Indiana, Midwestern boy. Always loved movies and television. Came out here to go to UCLA Film School, interested in independent film, really. That's really what I wanted to do. You know, it was late 80s and Steve Soderbergh and Jim Jarmusch and Spike Lee. And that, you know, that was a really exciting time. And so, and UCLA was a good place for that. And so I got out, wrote a feature, was sort of flavor of the month for a while, you know, and did a little bit of that. And never really thought about television because back at the time, TV really wasn't something that they, you know, it was the UCLA School of Theater, film, and television. You know, it was the redheaded stepchild kept in the closet. Even though there was really good stuff happening, it just, you know, there was a prestige. There's still attitude out here, you know, that if you made, you know, however ridiculous your movie is, you're still somehow superior to somebody who wrote the best TV show ever. There's a little bit of that. But at the time, it was pretty profound. And I hadn't really thought about television. There wasn't a lot that I watched at the time. There were a few, you know, I liked the Steve Bochco sort of cop procedural stuff. Mm. Twin Peaks was terrific. But I really hadn't thought about television. And then after having been flavor of the month for a while and after being less flavorful and a little bit more expensive, you know, looking for work, and I had a chance to meet Chris Carter. And actually, it was to pitch for Millennium.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Millennium was happening. And it was a good meeting, and ultimately didn't happen. And about a year later, I asked my agent, would they be interested in hearing some pitches? Because I fell in love with The X-Files, like everybody else. It was the first TV show I saw that like felt cinematic. You know, it felt like a movie every week. And it also, I loved the tone. I love creepy. It was just right in the pocket for the kind of stories and even the kind of features I had been trying to do. And so when I came in and pitched, I actually took a few of my feature ideas, which became standalone monster stories, and realized, oh, this could be adapted to a TV show, to an X-Files. Yeah. And so I pitched him 3 ideas. One of them is what would become The Rain King. And I developed that freelance with them. And at the end of that period, they offered me a staff position. And I knew nothing about television. I didn't know there were staffs. I didn't know there were writers' rooms. I didn't know anything about it. And I, to be honest, I was a little bit, I don't know if I want to work in television. And my wife was like, you love the show. Try it. And it was the best decision I ever made. You know, you come in, you write the script. You know, I had written features that had directors attached to it, and then something happened, and they never happened. I came in, wrote this Rain King episode. 2 weeks later, you know, we're in prep. And Kim Manners is directing. And as a writer who would ultimately become a producer, you're an integral part of the process. And it felt very much like what I wanted independent filmmaking to be. And you're on set. You know, they were very kind, even as a young staff writer, to bring me into post so I could watch and learn how they were doing that. They were very inclusive in the process. They did a great job of opening the door to all of us new writers to train us to be producers. And I fell in love. I fell in love with the process. I fell in love with the and I fell in love with television.
That's. I mean, it's amazing that your first actual TV credit is an X-Files episode. I mean, that's. I know before you'd written and directed a film called Radio Inside. Is that right? From earlier, I think was it you made a short film of that, and then you turned it into a feature. That was before the X-Files.
That is correct. But
yeah,
no, it was amazing. And the other thing was, I knew I liked X-Files, but again, because I wasn't really connected, and the internet was nascent at the time, I had no idea how crazy the fandom was. I had no idea that it was one of the hardest gigs to get. I had no idea that it was the zeitgeist show of the time. You know. And so ignorance was really bliss, and that I wasn't particularly nervous going in because I didn't know that stuff. And it really wasn't until I was on board that I saw the scope and scale of the machine that the X-Files had become.
Well, you mentioned just then about how you'd pitched a few ideas and you'd taken them from some of your previous movie ideas. There was one movie idea that I found when I was doing a little bit of research and looking into what you'd done that never got made, as far as I know, called Him Time in the Land of Abandon, which was before the Blacklist was a thing and, you know, the produced screenplays. This was being heralded back in the early 90s as this amazing piece of work that people should produce. And when I was reading the synopsis of that, it really struck me as something that reminded me a little bit of that kind of strange horror and strange terror essence of, like, middle America that you get a lot in the X-Files. So did you bring some of those kind of ideas then into some of the scripts you wrote or some of the ideas you had for the X-Files?
Well, 2 points. First, how the hell did you find out about that? that's a deep dive. That's a very deep dive.
The joys of the internet, Jeff. It's all there.
Yeah, it was for a while, it was one of the 10 best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood. You know, they used to do those lists. And it has remained an unproduced screenplay. But it was actually that script that got me hired.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Frank's assistant at the time was a woman named Michelle Fizikas, who has gone on to become a big writer, showrunner on her own with her partner, Tyra Butters. But at the time, she was Frank's assistant. Always be nice to the assistants. And and she read it and loved it and recommended me based on that material. And amazing. So I can't believe that you found that out. But yes, that was the writing sample. And I also think X-Files, look, I came in season 6, so they'd already done 100 stories. You know, having been on a show on shows that have done over 100 stories, you've done everything you can think of. So you're looking for fresh horses, you know? You're looking for fresh horses to come in with new ideas. And so that year there were three, me, David Ammon, and Daniel Arkin came in that year. And part of our job was just to come up with new stuff because they were really focusing on mythology stuff. You know, but everything we pitch, they go, we love it. Oh, we've done that. No, that's a great idea. That was season 3. No, love it. No, we've done it. And so there was a lot of that. So yeah, so Him Time got me in the door, and that was the tone of that was the kind of tone that I really liked. So,
do you mind me being a bit deep dive and sort of just telling the listeners quite what that was about based on the synopsis? Because I feel like it would give a bit of context to what we're saying. Him Time in the Land of Abandon. A lonely Indiana kid's life is altered forever when she discovers a battered old angel who can't speak and lives on Twinkies. So is the life of a single mum who's addicted to Italian language study tapes and abusive men. The mum's brooding living boyfriend, a science teacher, goes ballistic when he's faced with the same magical angel, and when he suspects his woman is falling in love with the angel's mysterious protector, he terrorises the mother and child. Does that sound along the right lines?
It is. Although I always refer to him as an old man with wings.
Okay.
And only because the backstory is he had been a freak in a carnival, and he's got dirty gray rat colored wings, and there's nothing angelic about him.
Yeah.
But the little girl believes he's an angel, and it's part of it's about what a child's faith can do.
Mm.
To get all high and mighty, there's a Dreyer film called Ordette, which is a movie that I fell in love with. And there's a little bit of that in there. But yeah, it's sort of Southern Gothic,
yeah,
with a bit of supernatural.
It sounds a bit like Carnival as well, the TV show that came later.
Carnival. When Carnival came on, I had so many people call me and say, "Are you doing that? Is that you?" That's what I wanted to bottle as a tone for a show.
Yeah.
And I honestly wish there'd been a bit more plot to go with that tone. But it was beautiful when I watched every episode. So yeah, it really does. It's astute. Yes, I'm very much in that world.
Yeah, it really does feel that way with this. And so, yeah, when we're talking about these kind of influences and such, it feels like they do drip feed into some of the scripts that come out. I mean, we have a Facebook group, the podcast, and we do have some listeners who've asked questions. And I invited them to ask you questions, and they quite feed into some of the things I wanted to ask. So, when we're talking about The Rain King, firstly, which was the first one that was made, or was certainly the first one that was released in the season running, it's known, obviously, as a favourite of the shipper community in The X-Files. And we recently discussed it on the show, actually, and it's sort of goes down as one of the... I would honestly say, Jeff, it is maybe the nicest, happiest episode of the entire show. You know, it has a real upbeatness to it.
That is true, and I think because of that, it's a very divisive episode. I think there are people who really like the episode, and I think there are people who think this episode is going to destroy the franchise.
Well, it's one of our listeners, Ellie, she wanted to know what kind of your objective was for Mulder and Scully in this episode. Did you knowingly go into it, creating what would become a shipper fave? And what are your thoughts on that perception generally?
Well, going in, you know, before I got there, the idea of just of somebody's emotions controlling the weather,
yeah,
you know, was sort of the what if, and so there's this unrequited love story, right? This man loves this woman, doesn't know how to tell her he loves her. Clearly, to everyone around him, he loves her. Well, then you've got our leads who clearly love each other, don't ever talk about it. And arguably, Mulder's the last guy you would turn to for romantic advice, just because he's like I don't know what you're talking about. So it seemed like a good way to tell a Mulder Scully story, you know, by somebody else going, "You're a handsome guy. You're clearly very good with women. Help me get the girl I love." And then, of course, it goes south when that guy's girlfriend falls for Mulder. And but, yeah, it was all built, you know, the shows are always built on feelings, right? What's the emotion? You can have a really cool plot, but how does it affect our characters? You know, and Chris and the guys were really great at creating those stories. You know, we all love the Darren Morgan stories. You know, yeah. We can't all do the Darren Morgan. He's so unique. But by season six, you could do a romantic comedy episode. I don't think you could, you know, you couldn't have done that in the first few seasons, you know, where nobody dies.
yeah.
And I think it's the first episode where nobody died.
Probably. Yeah.
And I was delighted by that, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that they were open to it, that like Frank and Chris and the guys were open to that kind of tone, meant a lot to me. And they were great partners in creating that and taking that episode and turning it into an X-File, you know, because it really is a very specific way of telling a story. And I had to learn, you know, we all who came in to write there had to learn how to write that dialectic, that Mulder Scully, they're both kind of half right, respectful for both characters, and learning how to do that. But it was such a joy to make. And Clayton Rohner, who played Daryl the Rain King, was just so much fun and had such a big personality in that. And I don't know, I had a great, it's one of the great memories for me is making that episode. Yeah, we made it rain, we made it hail, we made it snow. There were tornadoes. There was flooding. It was great. I had a great time doing that.
I think it's very fondly remembered, actually, The Rain King. I think there are a lot of fans of that episode. The fandom does seem to, if not split, then has its own little niches of people who love the romance or they love just the darker stuff. But I think there are a lot of fans of it. It's interesting when you talk about how it was in season six when you came in, because you've talked about how much of a great environment it was and how presumably Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz were dealing, like you said, with mythology aspects and some of those deeper aspects of the show. So how was it in terms of you being able to go off and write these kind of episodes yourself? Like you say, you had pointers and things like this, but were they busy dealing with the broader ideas of the show and the ongoing story, and were you left then to craft these much yourself? Or
to an extent, you know, there was really, when we came in, it was Chris, but they were also doing Millennium. Frank was running the show at the time, and then John and Vince. And so they were, so Frank, John, and Vince were really sort of, you know, they were all executive producers at the time when the rest of us were newbies. And so Chris and Frank tended to do the mythology episodes with, I think, John and Vince collaborating with them on that. And then John and Vince were also coming up with standalone episodes as well. And so, and then in a different build, you know, it was a little small building they were in. And so we were the trailer monkeys. We were in a different building.
Yeah.
And so whether it was me, David Amon, and Dan Arkin, or then later when Greg Walker and Steve Maeda came in, we would sort of form our own little mini room and work together. And then we would go over to what we called the big house, Casa Grande, and because it's Los Angeles, and pitch them the story. And so then they would respond to that. They would get, you know, they were looking, they always had a whole bunch of boards going. They were trying to figure out, because the standalones could kind of plug in anywhere into the season. And so some stories you get stuck on, so you'd move something up, or something just came quickly. And so we would all work on our own stories, help to each other in terms of, can you help me figure this out? And those guys would too, but mainly we'd come in, pitch to them. They would give feedback, adjustments. We'd go back and work. I mean, it's a version of what any writer's room is, which is, the people at the top are doing 5,000 things, and supervising the writers is one of that. And so we'd go in, do that. They'd make notes. We'd go back and work it back and forth until there was a board, a story that they said, great, do it. And we'd go off and write it. So it was very collaborative that way. But it was our job to, you know, generate as many ideas as we could, because, like I said, they'd already generated 1,000.
Yeah, so it was. Yeah, it sounds really creative. It sounds like a really, a great place in that sense to work. Was there any, while we're on this subject, did you notice any discernible change, or did you feel like things had changed from when they come from Vancouver, haven't they, from the previous 5 years? And I know you weren't in Vancouver with them at that point, but did they feel like it was different? Did it, from their perspective, those who'd carried over into both sort of, you know, eras of where the show was filmed at that point? Was there any real difference?
I think the only thing that was obviously different was they embraced the landscape difference. Like, you know, the very first episode of season six is desert. And they really embraced the ability to tell a different kind of story. You know, in Vancouver, you could do a lot. It was really easy to do all over the Midwest. It was really easy to duplicate a lot of different places. But then, you know, to do the desert, like I think they literally spray painted, you know, for Anasazi, they painted the rocks red, you know, and because they had that kind of resource. Yeah. But down here, they really leaned into, you know, the possibilities and the ocean and landscape and desert and mountains that you have here to tell a different kind of story. I don't think emotionally it was different, but I do think they embrace the physiological changes.
Yeah, that makes complete sense when you see what's on screen, definitely.
Yeah.
Later in the season then, there's Alpha, which is the second script, which really is quite a tonal contrast compared to The Rain King. I've always thought this feels like, in the context of season six, almost an old-fashioned kind of X-File, you know, in that season, because there's a lot of format-breaking, quite colourful episodes, quite like The Rain King in some senses, you know, which does things differently. If we move on to season seven, then you pen the Goldberg variation, which feels like an extension of the softness of The Rain King in many ways, which very much about the cosmic nature of Locke, quite melancholic sort of characters than some of the harsher aspects of the show. One of our listeners, Cortland, she thinks of this and The Rain King as happy ending X-Files that are quite rare on the show, and asks, was it difficult to write that kind of story in such a traditionally dark series? And again, this sort of goes back to The Rain King in that they are very much episodes where the shipper contingent, the people who love the romance, love the comedy between Mulder and Scully, get a lot of moments from that, a lot of flirtation or enjoyment. So was it, did you want to go back to something on similar lines to The Rain King, I guess, with that one?
I would say my natural inclination is in that pocket a little bit.
Mm.
And I liked a little bit of whimsy, but I think it needs to be grounded in something terrible happens. Otherwise it just floats away.
Yeah.
You know, I think life has both. And they were very supportive of the pitch from the get-go. And so tonally, they didn't come and say, well, it needs to be darker or it needs to be more of this. They were very supportive of the episode. Mm. And I think they liked the Rube Goldberg aspect of it, that everything was connected.
Yeah.
And I literally wrote it for Willie Garson, the guy who played Henry. I had just been a huge fan of his, and I just like this curmudgeon-y guy who had all this power and was just terrified of using it because there was always a consequence.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember when we were casting the little boy, we had all these cute Disney-trained actors come in and do their thing. And then suddenly, like 11-year-old Stanley Kowalski comes in. It's like, this is amazing. You know, with Shia LaBeouf came in as like a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, he was amazing.
Yeah.
He embodied the kid. You felt it. He wasn't acting. I mean, it was just out of the gate. Every now and then, you'll get these young people like this. There's a young actress now named Grace McKenna, who's now a teenager who's doing really well. I did a pilot with her a number of years ago, and she was like insane. It was just, she'd be talking to, yes, okay, go on screen, and just suddenly she's with her mom and she's weeping. I have no, you know, there are these kids who are amazing, and Shia was like that. But
I always think another good example of that, I always think, is Kiernan Shipka in Mad Men, because she's amazing for similar reasons.
Yeah. No, it was a really fun episode because the art department got full on board. They couldn't wait to design the little mouse. Do you have the game? It's called Mousetrap.
Yeah.
It's a little board game, you know, with the.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they got ahead of building those and just coming up with on set, trying to come up with the convoluted sequences that would do stuff. In the original pitch. Now, the other thing that was shocking to me is X-Files had money. When I came in, it was a big hit, and they spent a lot of money on an episode, which I didn't know was true until I went to my next show, and it was like, oh, no, we don't do it that way. I didn't know. But I had written the finale so that the whole thing was going to happen on a rooftop, and it was a $50 million feature. They're like, we like that idea, but let's, you know, we had to find another way to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was another really fun episode to put together.
Mm.
A happy ending, but, you know, it's a melancholy character. It's a... There's a tonal thing that hopefully it doesn't feel like a trifle.
Yeah. No, I like that one. I think it's a lot of fun I think it's the only X-Files episode that maybe has like the mafia in it, you know, has like mobsters and things like that. That's really great, you know. I also like Mark Snow's music as well in that one. I think he captures the tone of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's one, I don't know if he's an unsung genius of the show, but he's certainly a genius.
Yeah. For sure. Were there any differences actually with season 7 in terms of how it was being produced and how the writer's room worked? Was there any or was it much the same as season 6? Did it sort of carry on same fashion?
It was much the same. You know, we had some new writers. That's when Greg Walker and Steve Maeda showed up. They had been working on the short-lived Harsh Realm and had done a nice job on that show, and Chris and the guys had liked them and brought them over. But no, I went back before we got on to look at the episodes from season 6 and 7, and there's a lot of really fun episodes. I mean, tonally, like Vince had done Drive. There were a lot of things that were really unique, and they had sort of their Michael McKean Man in Black episodes, and just great. You know, it was I thought it was shocking that they were doing that much good work in season 6 and 7 from my perspective.
And they're still hugely popular with the fan base. I can tell you that. They really are. Those seasons are beloved for many reasons. Yeah. I think your next one is quite an underloved episode, however. Signs and Wonders. I really think it's strange and unnerving. And I will never forget, Jeff, the final image of Reverend Mackey and the snake with the mouse. Yeah. That is indelible for me, genuinely. I love that. I thought that was fantastic. One of those great final images that you just gives you chills at the end of an X-File. Again, it feels a little bit older style X-Files, more from the previous 5 years. How did this one come about? And was this very much in your wheelhouse in terms of some of the things you'd done previously before the X-Files?
Yeah, well, I think as much as they had indulged my lighter episode, I was told to write a scary one. And I had seen a documentary on a snake handling church, and I grew up, like I said, I grew up in Indiana, and I knew, you know, folks from Appalachia, and it just seemed sort of rife. And I also, you know, just a different way to look at issues of good and evil, and who's smarter than whom, I got like 2 hate letters from it.
Oh, wow.
Because which is back in the day, you'd get mail. You know, it wasn't like they were going, I hate you.
Yeah.
You know, with thumbs. It was, they'd actually take the time to write a letter and say, and it was an episode where I thought, well, if you're going to do God and the Devil, how do you do that in a way? And what if the crazy guy's right? You know, in a sense, the hardcore preacher was right in this instance. But somebody feared I was supporting intolerance. I was responsible for the death of Matthew Shepard, you know, a gay man who'd been killed. And it was all on me because of this.
Wow.
But I just thought, let's go tell an old fashioned good and evil story, you know, it was Kim Manners directed the hell out of it. You know, he had so much fun. He loved directing the horror episodes. and I was fortunate that he got to direct 2 of mine. I never had Rob Bowman, which made me sad, but Kim did 2 of those. And I thought he directed the shit out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely he did. And I feel like it's one of those, you talked about, you know, the desert kind of aspect, and this one captures the heat, I think, of that kind of area, you know, the south and all this. It really, I don't know if they'd have been able to do that quite as in the same way in Vancouver. You know, it really does.
I think you're right. No, it's another look. I love the short story writer, that was Flannery O'Connor. I'm a Southern Gothic fan, and so this was sort of my Southern Gothic Flannery O'Connor story.
Yeah. I love all that stuff. It's great. I really, really think it's a really, really, really good episode. Finally, then in season 8, we have Salvage, which there's multiple things here. It gives you the chance to write for the character of John Doggett, for one thing.
Right.
And I mean, I've always felt this stretch of episodes at the start of season 8 is one of the strongest, actually. And Salvage, in some ways, feels like it could be a Marvel or DC, maybe DC origin story in many ways. I mean, were there any comic book tropes in your head when you came up with Ray Pierce and his story?
Actually, it was, you probably know the Japanese Tetsuya. Do you know, there's a Japanese horror film, or it's sort of a metal fetish film.
Yes, I've heard of it. Yeah.
That I've always, it's, it's worth checking out.
Okay.
And it was this guy, metal fetishist, who basically starts putting metal into his body and turns into this man, metallic man.
Yeah.
And then at the time, like, smart metals were just beginning. And I had the teaser, I had the pitch for the teaser, which I love the teaser in the episode. You know, the guy standing in the middle of the road and the car coming at it, and just splitting around the guy.
Yeah.
And that was always, you know, you always go and you pitch a teaser. Mm. You'd always go in, and that was the big thing. You have a good teaser, you got a good teaser, you got a good teaser. And then, like, okay, what's the story about? Where are we going with that? And so that was the teaser from the get-go. And I always felt really good about that. And then figuring out all the other stuff came about beyond that. But it was this idea. Yeah, it was an origin story of a monster or of a hero, depending on how you look at it. And my favorite thing about that episode is so Wade Williams is the actor who played Ray Pierce. And so we're outside shooting somewhere, and he's got all this prosthetic on. You know, he's like mid-transformation. Not full on, but there's – he's – you know, he's definitely attracting attention. And he's walking around, and people are looking at him. And he came over to me and he says, "Now I know what it feels like to be beautiful." Which I thought was a great observation. You know, it was like everybody's just stopping and staring at this man.
Yeah.
And he was able to transform that into, oh, if I were beautiful, people might be looking at me the same way, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, I always love that observation of this.
It's a really good way of looking at it, yeah.
Another thing I should mention is that episode is set in Muncie, Indiana. Mm. And I'm from Indiana, and my mom and my grandparents are from Muncie.
Oh, cool.
And Muncie is back after World War II, there was some national thing where it was like middle town America. It was like cursed to be like average town America. And I always felt bad for it. And so it became sort of the butt of this Muncie, Indiana. And so I've written Muncie, Indiana to pretty much every show I've ever worked on. And when I did the X-File one, on the front page of the Sunday paper, there was a story about X-Files in Muncie. Not that we went there, not that we shot there.
Of course.
But that it was set there, because that was big news. And they interviewed my, like, 80-year-old grandmother. And the headline was, X-File writer gives granny the willies.
That's great.
And she was horrified. And I said, look, you were on the front page of the Muncie Star. You didn't have to die, kill somebody, rob a bank.
Yeah, that was great.
So, but that was Muncie, Indiana.
That's an awesome claim to fame for sure. Absolutely. I mean, was season 8 different then? Was it, because obviously a lot's changed, hasn't it? So we've got Robert Patrick as Doggett, Mulder's gone. The tone of the show. I mean, it really feels a lot more serious, a lot darker, a lot more paranoid, back, you know, much more like the early days of the X-Files. So did you really feel a difference writing for that season?
Yeah, I think part of it is we were trying to, I mean, just because of his character's background, and then later when they brought in Annabeth, same thing. It was like, you know, it was as if there was some of the Millennium had leaked over a little bit with sort of the occult crimes, and, you know, and there was a different flavor, because I think they were trying to figure out, how do we do this without having David all the time, you know? And I think rather than trying to imitate him, find out a different kind of personality. I think Robert was a good choice. Mm. But I think we were all figuring out how to tell that story and how to reset up the new dialectic between Doggett and Scully. And, you know, I think it's a learning curve. We were all trying to figure out as fast as we could.
And it comes out really well. I think it's really different, but it's getting a lot more reappreciation now, season 8, I think, with a lot of distance, which is great, I think, because I've been a fan for a long time. So a couple of people have asked whether you had any unrealized episode ideas. I know you came in and pitched a few. Was there anything else that you wanted to do that didn't actually happen or anything like that?
Well, sure. There always are. You know, yeah. You always have a bunch of things. And look, there were a couple of things I pitched that I really loved. And evidently they did too, because they had made them seasons before. Yeah. Other people. You know, was just the reality of coming in when I did. Mm. And so, yeah, there were a couple ideas that I really loved and they were just too close. You know, that's the thing. And so it became like, okay, well, the obvious answer would be this, but we've done that. So how can we flip it and turn it into something else? Mm. And so stories sometimes had to become more complicated simply because the more relevant answer had already been done. Yep. And so you had to find a new way to do it or tell that story.
Would any of those maybe unrealized ideas that had already been done, were they lighter? Were they more in the wheelhouse of Signs and Wonders? Were they, what kind of tone would some of those ideas been from what you remember?
They were actually a little more sci-fi.
Okay.
Just in terms of tech, there was some tech involved and there was some nascent internet stuff because, you know, that was all kind of new. Mm. And artificial intelligence was new and all that. So look, I like genre stuff, you know, and I like all those different tones. And the beauty of the X-Files was you could sort of let different ones of those seep into it, whether it was, you know, an action thriller or, you know, a haunted house or, you know, a spooky tech kind of thing. So I couldn't have asked for a better first job in television than that for the kinds of stories I was interested in.
Yeah. Different things you could do. With season 9, then, was it the reality of then, because you then went to work on Angel, didn't you, during the third season? Was it a reality of being involved in that that meant that you didn't write beyond Salvage any more episodes of The X-Files?
No, it really just, that's just sort of how it happened. You know, we're all pitching stories and, you know, some, you pitch ideas and sometimes they like them and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you get more and sometimes you get less. And that's just how that worked out.
Mm. Fair enough. Yeah, that's okay. Speaking of Angel, I hope you don't mind if I ask you a couple of other things before we wrap up, because there's some real interest. Carl is interested to know what it was like working with Joss Whedon during this period, because you had quite a big role in Angel, didn't you, during that season and then onwards and into the fourth and fifth season. So what was that like?
Yeah. I came over season 3 and then I was there. Then I ran it seasons 4 and 5.
Yeah.
David, you know, Joss at the time was doing Buffy as well. And so David Greenwalt was running the show at the time. Mm. And we pitched to Joss and, you know, I had a very good experience there. And then season 4, there's also a guy named Tim Minear, super talented writer, who was sort of the number 2, but just really a great, great story guy and great writer. So much so that when Joss launched Firefly, he went up, he picked Tim to run Firefly. And so, and then David went off to do Miracles, which was a one season series over at ABC. And that left me as last man standing. And look, I have to say, you know, I was a co-producer. I was a mid-level guy and they were looking to bring somebody in and Joss was like, Bell can do it. So, you know, he was very supportive of that. And it was a great group of writers at Angel, you know, great, unbelievable, great group, especially that last season. You know, we had David Fury and Ben Edlund and Drew Goddard and Steve DeKnight, Liz and Sarah, who have gone off and done great things. David Fury, I don't know if I said that already. Just everybody were rock stars. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was a great experience.
A friend of mine, Matt, is a massive fan of the Buffyverse stuff, and he said to me before this discussion, please tell him how amazed I was about the end of Forgiving in season 3 of Angel, which was the big shock moment involving Wesley and Connor. And he said my jaw just hit the floor, that kind of storytelling. He wanted you to know, to be fair, because he loved that.
I appreciate that, but I got to give Joss credit for the,
oh, right.
the super cool there. That's the problem. You come up with something really cool and go, oh, yeah, and then he takes a pillow and tries to smother it, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, there's these moments of like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So, yeah, I wrote it, but it's pitched by few, and there are certain moments you just got to say, you know, it's awkward for all of us when somebody would write an episode and then somebody would come up to that person and say, my favorite line was this. And they'd have to go, yeah, Bell wrote that. or I would have written an episode and somebody goes, I love that line.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, that's Ben Edlund. And you know, it's just the reality. You take the best. When you finish the script, you sit there and everybody reads it and everybody pitches stuff. And there were so many good writers that if there's a better line, you know, a better joke, a better reaction, you take it. That's the beauty of television.
Mm,
sure. That collective mind.
Well, on the back of that, I know you weren't obviously showrunning The X-Files, but did you ever have moments where you were involved in any of the other scripts? Are there any lines or in any scripts where that is Jeff Bell instead of the actual writer credit?
No. There were episodes where they asked us to help break them, but but no, that was a much more self-contained place.
Okay.
There really wasn't a writer's room as per se. We all kind of did much more of our own stuff and we get notes. And so, you know, Vince would have a line or John or Frank might have a line or pitch or something or want something sharpened. But no, I can't say that the water flowed both ways.
It's just very interesting because, you know, over time you hear writers talking about how these things work. It's interesting to see how it differs with different shows. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously then you wrote the finale of what turned out to be the finale of Angel as well, didn't you? And was it quite a big moment, you know, in terms of being involved in that?
Well, we knew it was good. The good news was that Joss had gone to, it was the WB at the time. And so, because every year we were on the bubble, every year was like, are we coming back or not? And we didn't know. And so he went to them and said, we really need to know whether we're coming back or not so we can write a finale or not. And they said, this will be the last year. And so we knew that going into the season. Or not, we didn't know going into the season. We knew that in the back half of the season. And so we steered towards that. And, you know, the original idea, because it's Joss's show, that ultimately that he would write and direct it, and he was too busy with everything else that was happening, and so I wrote it with him. There were scenes that he really wanted to write, and then he let me direct it, and so that was a big privilege. I'm very proud of that. I think it's a really good end to a series, and that last line is Joss's, which is "Let's go to work." and to me, that's the perfect thing. It's like, even though the show is ending, these guys will continue to do what they're doing. That was a great group there. That was hard though, because what I didn't realize after going X-Files and Angel, I didn't realize it was normal. It wasn't normal that half every week the crew's staying up all night shooting. You know, it was like no more vampire show, no more monster shows. I'd like to work like during daylight. The crews work so hard, you know. The term called Fratterday, because your Friday call would be 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
Because you're going to work until dawn, you know, because it's a night shoot. And those crews work so hard. They work so hard.
Did you find that experience then on where you did get to shoot a bit more in the day, on Alias, because that is one of my personal favourite shows. I think it's massively underrated. And I see a lot of connective tissue between that and The X-Files, I think. And you obviously wrote and directed a couple of episodes in the final two seasons of that show.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, again, did you work much with J.J. Abrams at that point? And was that the kind of show where it changed in terms of production and things like that?
Well, at the time, you know, J.J. was doing, when I came in season four, I think the same thing. They were looking for some fresh blood, tell stories. And I think with my other credits, it seemed like a good fit. And I loved the show. I loved the show like you did. and felt like I could write it pretty well. And it was a good fit. And so they were really looking to find, like Mulder and Scully, you had Sidney and Vaughn, you had a love story at the center of it, you had a mythology behind it, and you had standalone episodes that connected. So I know, I think that's why they came to me.
That was a lot
of fun to write. And, I wish I had horrible stories to tell, but honestly, delightful cast, delightful crew, was great.
Yeah. And you got to write, in that show, you got to write two very different kind of episodes, because you got to write, well, I suppose three, really, because you got to write Ice, and yes. which was much more of that standalone story with those romantic elements, and then The Descent, which was full-on Rambaldi mythology, right in the thick of the end of all that. And those couldn't be more different, really, in many ways, could they, in terms of approach?
No, and that's what was fun about the show. You know, I do.
Yeah.
Here's what I like. I love a show where you can feel the writer behind the, you know, I don't like where every episode feels the same.
Mm.
Like, I'll watch Law and Order, I like that, but I wouldn't want to write that every week.
Yeah.
And I loved that on X-Files, you could tell a Vince episode or a Chris episode or a Frank episode or Darren or a Morgan and Wong episode, or, you know, you can they let the writer's sensibility breathe through a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely true on Angel too, and that, like, a Steve the Knight story felt very different than a Ben Edlund story, for instance. And I just felt that at least you could do that. Again, not so much it was about me, but it could be funny, it could be sad, it could be strange, it could be, they didn't all feel the same. Mm. It's not so much the authorial voice behind it, because it was all JJ's show, but tonally it could be very different. You know, you had such a wide range of characters that it really allowed you didn't feel like you were just stuck writing the same scene every week.
Mm.
And those shows are fun to write.
Yeah. I guess it was similar then for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., obviously, wasn't it? Because you were involved in that for the whole run, really. Like, from the second episode and up to the seventh season.
I was in the room as we were writing the pilot, so I was brought in from the get-go.
Amazing. Right from the very beginning. And that really reminds me of Alias, that show. There's so many, particularly in the early days, you know, and then obviously later on it gets much more sci-fi and that kind of thing in many ways. But yeah, I mean, that must have been an amazing experience to go right from the very beginning to the end with that show.
It was. It was, again, a great group of people. And, you know, coming out of the gate, there were expectations for what the show would be. No, they're not going to let Iron Man come onto our TV show. No, Thor's not dropping on. You know, and so there were expectations with that. And the other thing was, Coulson was the only real big Marvel character in the show. So we had five new characters. They were like, "Boo, we don't know who these people are." And as they fell in love with them, they started to really care about that and kind of really turned it around. Mm. So very proud of the show. We had a great time writing that.
Yeah, that final season was great. That, particularly the time traveling stuff, was just so much fun.
That was the season where we thought, well, what the hell, let's just go for it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we jumped the shark. Let's just high five the shark as we're jumping past. Let's just really let's push it. Let's, you know, honestly, let's try. What if we do that? Yeah. Okay, let's try it.
Yeah.
And so, very happy with those episodes. I think some really emotional episodes in that. So thank you. We had a good time doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell, because it really comes out that way. Were you disappointed that the spin-off didn't happen, the Most Wanted idea?
Oh, horribly. Yeah, horribly. Terribly disappointed.
Because were you showrunning that one? Was that going to be something you did?
I wrote that with Paul Spyszewski, who was one of our writers on S.H.I.E.L.D. And the idea is we would go off and do that, but I would kind of have a hand, you know, kind of oversee both. But it didn't happen.
A shame, because I remember at the time it seemed like it made a world of sense, you know.
we were told it was a go until it wasn't, so there you have it.
Yeah.
you mentioned
Paul Spyszewski, though. Is he the same guy that you work with on Daybreak as well? Because
yeah is.
Seriously, Jeff, Daybreak, and my friend Matt, who I mentioned earlier, will agree with me on this. One of the most disappointing cancellations ever. That show was great. That was 13 episodes of brilliance, and I'm so sad that that didn't carry on.
Thanks. It's one of my proudest. One of the things I'm most proud of. We were ahead of our time. I think if you could stream that now, it would have been a big hit.
Yeah.
And I'm sad that it's not really out there now. It's not like it's on Hulu. It's not something that people can readily find. I think it would do really well now. Mm. But we worked so hard on that, and I was sad that it didn't do it. You know, we were on the wrong network, I think. ABC, you know, our lead in was So You Think, the ballroom dancing competition show. And to go from that to Tay Diggs with a gun, thanks for missing. Paul will be thrilled that you said that. So,
yeah, please pass that on. Because, anyone listening, if you've never seen Daybreak, go and find it wherever it is. It is out there on DVD or Blu-ray. You can get it on Amazon. Make sure it happens. It's great. So, finally then, spinning back to The X-Files, did you watch any of the new seasons a couple of years ago? And if so, what did you think?
You know, I wanted to see them and I haven't. I'll check them out at some point.
Okay, that's fine. Well, that's about it, really. I've touched on, you know, the episodes, you know, you've written. I've touched upon some of the other stuff you've done. It's amazing. You've written so many things that I genuinely love. So thank you for so much for this conversation. It's been really, really delightful to speak to you.
Well, thank you for allowing myself just to talk about myself and blow my own horn for a while. So thank you, Tony. You know, I love when people love what I do. So
yeah, and I'm not alone. Absolutely. So what's next for you then? What's coming up? What's happening?
Great question. You know, COVID came along and trying to generate some new material, trying to go out with some stuff. And so we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, best of luck with it. And fingers crossed, you know, we see more from you soon. That'd be brilliant. Do you have a website or anywhere you can direct people to for what you do? Or
no, the thing is I've rejected all of that. I'm not on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I've tapped out of all of that. So if you have a tin can with a string and you listen carefully, occasionally you might hear something. But other than that, you won't hear from me.
Fair enough. Just go. Everyone, just go and watch the stuff Jeff does. That's where it's at. Absolutely. Watch the TV and beyond. Well, thank you again for joining me, and thanks, listeners, for joining me for the episode. Remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network, and the X-Files is not all we're discussing. So we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed on the network in a minute. But until then, remember, as always, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Movie Palace.
Yeah, I can remember my first viewing of The Sound of Music quite distinctly, actually, because it was 8 days ago.
You've never seen it before that?
8 days ago was the first time I'd sat down to watch it from start to finish. Now, I always associate The Sound of Music. It's interesting that you both talk about it as an Easter thing. It is associated with bank holidays here, but I don't think it's just Easter. So I had seen a lot of these sequences. I think if I was inside on a bank holiday when I was a child and The Sound of Music was on, it was normally a bad thing because it meant it was raining and I couldn't go out and play football.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
I've got 5 tattoos. So I started getting tattoos when I was about 5 years ago, and it was just sort of one by one, I guess. So not huge coverage, but I'm definitely got the bug, so to speak. So, but the latest one is the Red Dwarf one. Yeah,
and that's the one you've decided to talk about today. Describe it for me.
Yeah.
Free with this month's issue.
Obviously, you must remember the sign in musical exchanges.
I do indeed.
Do not play. Yeah, there was a few riffs, weren't there, that you weren't allowed to play? This being top of them.
Enter Sandman, Smoke on the Water, Stairway to Heaven, anything widdly above the 12th fret, I think that song said.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that paid no attention to that shit. Remember when we almost got thrown out for playing with that delay pedal?
Yes.
It was was amazing.
I also remember the day that I went in with my birthday money to Musical Exchanges to buy a pedal, and I ended up buying the Boss Hyper Metal, and I was insisting to the bloke that I was buying it from. I was like, I don't really play much metal, I just like the sound of it. I want to use it for sort of, you know, more experimental sounds, like you're wearing a Metallica t-shirt.
I'm not that into metal, actually. I want to do something more like Swans with it, like My Bloody Valentine, that kind of thing.
Which I did, but I was wearing a Metallica t-shirt at the time.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.